On today's College Football Inquirer, the College Football Playoff semifinals are here in the desert. We have Ole Miss playing Miami, but also Ole Miss dealing with some regulatory stuff that will affect next season because they might have a quarterback for next year, according to our Ross Dellinger. In Atlanta, Indiana and Oregon rematch. It was a great game the first time around. Probably both teams are better right now. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll talk about it all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is College Football Inquirer with a recovered Ross Dellinger and with Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples. Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Much better than yesterday morning, thank you. Sunday morning, I should say, as this probably drops on Tuesday. But I appreciate everybody holding on to the fort while I recovered from whatever I ate that did not sit well. And that's to the extent that you probably want to know.
Are you blaming the city of New Orleans? Yeah, we took the liberty of making fun of New Orleans for you.
Yes. Well, I don't think so, because it was a full like day and a half removed from that. So I wouldn't think so. It was something when
so this is the DC deep state we need to be blaming for.
This must be, that's right. It must be.
Guess you could say you drained the swamp.
Yes. Thank you. Godfrey, good one. Very good. Yes. My swamp was drained, put it that way.
Well, we have some great games coming up. The college football playoff semifinals, very exciting. I love this, and we've talked about this already. We talked about it after the matchups were set, but I really believe this is the first time we've had a Final Four where it felt like every team could actually win the national title. And I think that's a very exciting situation for the sport. And let's start with the Fiesta Bowl. Since it's the first one, it's on Thursday. But also because Ross has an incredible story up at Yahoo.com about Trinidad Chambliss, the Ole Miss quarterback. And so as we record this on Monday, we're only actually a few hours removed from a 2:35 a.m. Eastern tweet from Pete Golding, the Ole Miss head coach, of the Trinidad and Tobago flag. And then I read Ross's story, and you know why he tweeted that. So early slash late. What was going on there, Ross?
Yeah, this has been sort of a wild, the whole Ole Miss, really, since Thanksgiving, or maybe before Thanksgiving, the whole Ole Miss, like, saga of the last 6 weeks has been one that I've never quite seen in college football. It's been pretty wild to follow. I feel like I should just go ahead and buy a condo in Oxford right there on the square. And
the value would go up. It's fine.
Yeah. So the latest chapter in this saga is that Trinidad in the dark of night, overnight around 2 a.m. signed an agreement with Ole Miss, contingent on him getting an extra year of eligibility. So the NCAA is still haven't decided on his six-year of eligibility. Ole Miss sent the NCAA a waiver request in November. Trinidad hired a lawyer, Tom Mars, about 2 weeks ago, and they sent around 93, 94 pages of documents to the NCAA in two separate filings to try to get him this sixth year. While all this was going on over the last couple of weeks, it's clear that another program who has Ole Miss's former coach was very interested in Trinidad and very interested in Trinidad getting into the portal. And is not going to happen now. As we see, Trinidad is re-signed with Ole Miss. And if he does get his year, he will play there. So that's the latest chapter in this Ole Miss drama of a 2025 season storybook.
First two thoughts are, I'm sure the NCAA will treat Ole Miss fairly because they don't have any history with one another at all. And my second thought is I find it deeply funny that Tom Mars is now working on behalf of that effort. But the most undefeated and most powerful team in college sports is billable hours. So shout out to Tom for always finding a way to get to the end zone.
I will say these hours, Godfrey, aren't going to be billable. He's doing it quid pro quo for Mr. Chambliss.
Quid pro quo? So what's Chambliss giving him?
I think.
You mean pro bono?
No, not you scratch my back, I scratch yours.
I want Trinidad bono. To do, I want a Tom Cruise commercial.
I got loaned. Godfrey immediately was like, what is he going to do for him? Sorry, pro bono.
Right, what's Trinidad?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Trinidad giving QB lessons to somebody in Tom Cruise?
My legal term straight there. Pro bono. So no charge for this one, but yes, Tom Mars is back rattling the NCAA's cage.
Yeah, well, I do need to. Yeah, he and I probably would have a lot to discuss if we ever sat down and had like a coffee or a cocktail in terms of fun times with the NCAA. But what, Ross, is the likelihood of this? I think that's what everyone's kind of asked is, do we have any way of measuring the probability of a successful claim?
I think the way I understood it through the last few weeks was there was the NCAA requested more information even after Ole Miss sent the first filing of 91 pages. The NCAA requested more info specifically from Ferris State, from what I understand. Well, I guess we should tell the audience exactly what's happening here.
Right.
So
every situation is different, and he played at Ferris State for his first 4 years, redshirted 1 year there, was only the starter at Ferris State for 1 year. So this is like the Trinidad Shambliss story is even better, like as a Disney movie than you think it is, because he had to win the Ferris State starting job as a redshirt junior going into his fourth year in 2024. And yeah. Ross, I will let you explain the enlarged tonsils.
Yeah, in 2022, well, first of all, 2021 was his freshman season. He took a red shirt as a freshman. And obviously, NCAA gives you 5 years to play four, so you get one red shirt. So that was it, right? He burned the red shirt. In 2022, he didn't play. And at the end of that season, he did go to a doctor about, he had respiratory issues that season, breathing issues, because he had enlarged tonsils that needed to be removed after that season, so they removed them. Though 3 years later, right, he's trying to get that year back, that medical hardship back, and so he's requesting that extra year through the NCAA, and he's provided the doctor's statement and information on his doctor visit with the why he missed the 2022 season. Look, in like a case normally like this, the NCAA's often denied these cases. And just like looking at past cases, if there wasn't some kind of like really significant injury, broken leg sort of thing, whatever, you know, maybe a significant family event, they've denied a lot of these. So the thought going into like the last couple weeks, to get back to Godfrey's question, is this was unlikely to be approved. But over the last few days, for whatever reason, I sense a little more optimism from the Ole Miss folks, in from Trinidad's family, who I talked to over the weekend, and they seem a little more optimistic and confident in him being granted the waiver. But again, it's just kind of a coin flip. We don't know. But if he's not granted the waiver, it may be perhaps a reason that he signed a document giving him millions of dollars if he's granted the waiver, is that if the waiver is denied, this paves the way, his new agreement with Ole Miss, to sue over the worth of the agreement, which goes undisclosed, but his agent told me on the record quoted in that story that the top QBs, if you include incentives in their contract, are going for $6-7 million. So that's a lot of money and stands to be a potential lawsuit if the waiver is denied.
Yeah, the reported amount for Brendan Sorsby at Texas Tech is $5 million. Mm-hmm. But yes, this would be suing the NCAA over its eligibility rules, not anybody else. The thing is, this is where it's interesting, because I do feel like in most cases, the athlete has the advantage, or even the coach has the advantage in these situations when they sue the NCAA. This is the one where I feel like in an antitrust suit, the NCAA might be able to argue it's a pro-competitive justification and win.
Okay.
Because I kind of think the audience does, or the consumer does care about whether these are college students and not, you know, 37 year olds.
I get that. And that's definitely a concern, and the idea of this, what's going on in basketball might be a topic for another day, and that we are mm-hmm. not currently experiencing that. But I've also seen a fresh spate of really stupid semantic issues with eligibility, especially now as we are seeing players move from lower divisions like Trinidad Chambliss. Right.
You can be a pro in Europe, but you can't be a pro in America. Right. And that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you guys know who, have you guys heard the story of Rex Connors? Rex Connors is a defensive back at UC Davis. Okay. Do you guys know what happened to UC Davis this year? They had a game. It was the only game that I can think of in the FCS or the FBS.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was canceled in game. Yeah. It was actually just considered a no contest.
It was week zero game, right?
It was a week zero game. I was doing a live podcast watching it in the lobby. And it was week zero. It was in my hometown of Macon, Georgia, against Mercer. There were lightning storms that caused the typical, you know, hey, everybody's got to leave the stadium, do all that kind of deal. The problem was that because it was basically a sort of arranged FCS showcase game between playoff teams, UC Davis had to get home because they had to play a schedule, right? They had a week one opponent. And Davis, California, for those of you who don't know, is north of the Bay Area, Macon, Georgia, other side of the map. Mm. So we had to call the game because of travel concerns. And basically both teams had to prep for their following week's opponent. So a decision was made to kill the game. Now, this is where it's interesting. The NCAA struck the game. And what that means specifically is it doesn't exist in the any kind of record book, any kind of rushing yardage or tackle or statistic. They also told the FCS playoff selection committee, you cannot consider the result, which I believe UC Davis was leading in that game against Mercer. Both of these were playoff teams. But you can consider how they played anecdotally in the selection. So just the FCS selection committee is occasionally as dumb as the FBS one. But here's the weird thing. Connors got injured September 27th. The NCAA is counting the game that didn't happen, the game that didn't exist against Mercer, against him to get eligibility. He had a season-ending knee injury. I heard about this yesterday.
Preseason Big Sky Defensive Player of the Year. So this is someone who would be of significant value.
Wow.
UC Davis is trying to get him eligible to bring him back, let alone he's trying to get eligible, as Andy mentioned, to basically further his career, maybe put some cash in his pocket. So a game that doesn't exist in the record books, doesn't exist in any kind of media guide, and isn't allowed for consideration for any other aspect is being held against a kid who played in it.
And this is why the NCAA loses these things when they go to court.
Yeah, because they do this semantic nonsense, and people like, me for one, in the media, just can't wait to jump their ass because of the ridiculous hypocrisy. And this stuff can be legislated away. This should be an easy one.
That is wild. I've never heard one quite like that. That is a unique one. I will say, the NCAA, I think there's been around 40. Of the eligibility cases filed in the last year, right? Since probably Diego Pavia's last December. Mm-hmm. So the last year there's been around 40, and the NCAA's won or gotten a dismissal or the case dropped in more than half. I think it's 13 or 14 that players have won. And the NCAA's won over 20, maybe 24, 25, somewhere around there. So they're surprisingly, winning the preliminary, at least, decisions for an injunction on some of these cases. But like that one that Godfrey just went through, I cannot imagine them winning that.
Right, exactly. And that's what kills them and stuff like this. Because I actually, like I said, I think they would have a chance in a full-scale class action lawsuit over the eligibility calendar, timetable. I think they could win that because I do think the end consumer does want there to be something like that. Like, I don't care. We found out the end consumer really doesn't care if they get paid or not. And
correct.
But I do think they don't want open-ended eligibility.
I'm guessing. There's a lot of shades of gray here, and there's no way to completely sort of gauge the accurate temperature of, quote, the consumer. But I do think there's a world of difference between Diego Pavia hanging around at Vanderbilt and a 36-year-old quarterback suddenly showing up. What's going on in basketball almost feels like a universal way from some of the cases that we're discussing in football. And specifically what I'm talking about in basketball are actual professional players who have not exhausted their collegiate eligibility going to play in college And that's probably not something we would see because of the physiology of football.
Yeah, and because the fact you simply cannot play professional football until you've been out of high school for 3 years.
Right.
It's just not, it's not going to happen.
So unless you had some sort of NFL spring up that was outside of NFL's government, I mean, sorry, a professional football league that would spring up in another country outside of the NFL's governance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much it. All right. Well, let's talk about Trinidad Shambliss on the field, because if he doesn't win this waiver, we're looking at either one or two more games left in this magical run for him. And this guy is just an amazing story. And, you know, I think Miami's favored in this game by like 3 or 3.5 points. Mm-hmm. But I think Trinidad Shambliss is the difference maker. He's the one that makes them different and makes it possible for Ole Miss to win this game. Because I mean, look at what he did against Georgia. He was magic in the fourth quarter. Absolute magic. And yes, Miami has played mobile quarterbacks. Yes, Miami has shut down good quarterbacks. But Georgia has a pretty good pass rush too. And it didn't matter against Trinidad Shambliss. And that's what I think is so much fun about this game, because Miami shut down A&M, shut down Ohio State offensively. Maybe they can do that to Ole Miss, but it seems like when Shambliss is on the field, that's not possible.
They're going to have to be, after watching that fourth quarter film, I would imagine, because he did play. It was one of the most interesting things in the interviews for this story on him, is interviewing his dad. They were all, you know, he was at the Superdome watching. And during the fourth quarter, he said he kind of said to himself as he's watching Trinidad do these Johnny Manziel things and run around like crazy and heave the ball downfield. Finally, right? Like, finally, the kid that I used to see at Ferris and used to see in high school has come out at Ole Miss. And so he said that Trinidad was really playing more conservative early in the year. And there's probably a reason behind that, right? He just got thrown into major college football and didn't even know he was going to be any kind of starter, was probably going to be a role player at Ole Miss. And so he's playing probably a little bit more conservative. And boom, we saw like the old Trinidad, as his dad said, come out against Georgia. And partly the reason behind that, I think, was because, well, one, Ole Miss was down in an elimination game.
It's win or go home. But, yeah, there's no choice.
Yeah. But two, Georgia pressured him enough, chased him out of the pocket. And that's what Miami obviously does really well with Reuben Bain and all the other defensive freaks that they have. Like, and so that they got to be careful, right, with that.
Now, we did see them against Marcel Reed, who is very slippery as well. And they sacked him 7 times.
They did.
He slipped the pocket once or twice, but they actually forced him to stay in the pocket and throw from the pocket. And that was the difference in that game, which was a 10-3 Miami win.
That's what you have to do. Trinidad's touchdown to interception ratio is insane. I think it's 21-3.
You
don't force him into a lot of turnover situations.
Yeah.
But I do think that you have to find a way to create some sort of pressure, like Andy said, to keep him boxed in without overcommitting. Because a lot of what Georgia did, I think, was risk reward. That just, I mean, at a certain point, you can't blame scheme for a busted play. But Miami doesn't want to find themselves in those over pursuit situations, because that's where Ole Miss has killed people this year.
Here's how I think you limit Trinidad. It's Miami's offense, which their game plans in the first two games will play into this as well, because they've basically designed their game plans for Texas A&M and Ohio State to limit the risk through the air with Carson Beck and try to do as much as they can on the ground, or have Carson Beck throwing these very high percentage, high confidence passes to playmakers who then, if they can get in space, can make something happen. But if I'm Ole Miss, I'm trying like hell to stop Miami from running up the middle, to stop that duo play that they love. And if you can get them less confident in their running game and force them to force Carson Beck into beating you, then it's not just that you might be able to make Carson Beck throw an interception, it's that the series may go faster. Miami is going to want to have 8-minute drives where they just maul you down the field. The last drive of the Ohio State game is kind of their ideal. And an offense like Ole Miss's thrives on rhythm. If you keep them off the field for like 8 minutes of game time, depending on quarter breaks, timeouts, all that, can be 30 to 40 minutes of real time. that can be a problem.
There's a temptation to compare the Carson Beck Georgia performance in Oxford. I would guard against that because that Ole Miss defense is made up so differently. And also there's four NFL players in that rush seven, rush six group that were so aggressive that day.
Walter Nolan, Chris Paul,
JJ
Jared Ivey. Like they were really good up front. Now they're good. They're still good up front. Like that's the thing. Ole Miss did not take as big of a step back as people think defensively.
You had a first, third, fifth, sixth rounder of TFLs in that game alone. I think it was the PFF grade of a 41, which was their season low in pass blocking. Mm. This is a different style of Ole Miss in terms of defense. They're not that talented up front.
So it's a much better Miami offensive line than that Georgia offensive line.
And that's what I wanted to get at is I think they'll better protect him. And I don't know if that's necessarily the game. I mean, look, send the house if you think it'll work. And Golden quietly has become, even now still as a head coach, a much better defensive coordinator in game than I think he may, than really he ever was at Alabama. I think he's kind of found his own rhythm. I think he's found a confidence level. You know, he was embattled for a lot of the time that he was in Tuscaloosa. I feel like one of the good things that Lane did for Golding when he got to Oxford was really kind of hand him that side of the ball. And so he's been creative. I think he's been impressive statistically with some of the things he's done relative to the talent they had going, talking more like pre-2024 at Ole Miss. I'll be curious. I just don't know I've seen a lot of talk about that Georgia game this week in 2024. I don't think it will play out quite like that because I think
Miami's
line.
I was on the field that entire game, and I have a hard time comparing those two because that was when Georgia was in the throes of some bad offensive line injuries. They were shuffling offensive linemen within that game quite a bit. That's not Miami. Like this Miami team has a very good offensive line. They are very confident in. They feel very good about everybody there. So I do think Beck will get protected. I just want to know, can they run the ball on this Ole Miss team? Because this Ole Miss team, like those D tackles, they are big. And they are hard to move. And granted, Ohio State had those too, and they moved them.
I mean, consider Andy that if Georgia was a little bit more committed to the run, and I'm not trying to live the trope here.
If Dave Frazier doesn't get hurt, I think it may go differently.
But I think even on that last drive when they're in the end zone instead of the throw, just running Stetson one more time, like it would have changed the entire complexion of the game. Gunnar Stockton, insert Georgia name here. putting Gunnar Stockton in on a keeper with whatever probability that has of success versus the incompletion would have pretty much handicapped Ole Miss's ability to go down the field.
And there's not time for that Trinidad throw that set up the field goal.
And then Georgia, I think, takes the game to overtime and I think has the advantage going into overtime. I think there were some play calling decisions that if you erase those, we're talking about a Georgia-Miami game anyway. So I tend to like the idea of Miami being able to run with some authority or at least run the ball more later.
Well, I think on Georgia's last drive of the game where they kind of induced those two secondary penalties, you remember the holding and the pass interference, maybe highlights sort of a weak link. I had one of the coaches on the staff mention that Georgia should have attacked that a little more maybe earlier in the game. So maybe Ole Miss's defensive backs, that's where you could see Baby Jesus, Malachi Toney, and C.J. Daniels and those sort of exploiting that area if they give Carson Beck enough time. Because as you mentioned, that Ole Miss defensive front, maybe not as good as last year, but still really good.
Ross, are you advocating for the all PI offense? Drawing PI?
Shout out to
Jane Costin from the New York Times. She coined that term, the all PI offense. Just constantly the all PI throw offense. Fades.
I like it. Okay.
Yeah. You don't throw fades, Godfrey. You throw back shoulders.
Yeah.
Force the receiver to fight back through the DB. They always throw the flag on the DB, even though the receiver is the one trying to fight through the DB who is in phase.
By the way, best back shoulder, talking about Trinidad, that was the best back shoulder I think I've seen all season. Against the last touchdown against Georgia. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like,
I've
seen five or six Ole Miss games this year, I think, but I thought his accuracy was another part that we haven't really discussed.
Yeah, I know his accuracy was insane in that game and has been pretty damn good all year. I think he's maybe top 25 in the nation in accuracy, but in that game, he had at one point in the fourth quarter, or maybe just in the second half, it spanned the third and fourth quarter. He had completed nine straight passes, and a lot of those were him like on the run, like crazy, and in the air, like 10, 15, 20 yards. the 1-2 when he hit, you know, to set up the field goal, he hit Stribling, I think, in stride. Was incredible. And before that, when he did the Johnny Manziel, like, pirouetting away from defenders, he hit Kiwon Lacy, who Trinidad was on the run. Kiwon was on the run. And he hit him, like, in stride down the sideline.
Kiwon Lacy holding on to that ball.
Yeah.
With his shoulder. It's one of the more underrated moments of the CFP so far.
And then picked up the first down, but because, he lowered the shoulder and got an extra 2 yards.
If I want to be ruthless for a second, if you're looking for game strategies in Miami, Kiwon Lacy, attack. I hate to be brutal, but like Miami is a physical defense, if nothing else. And you have a running back who's not going to be 100% carrying that ball.
Yeah, it didn't seem to stop against Jordan. Now, I know he had the fumble.
We had that fumble.
But you look at the numbers on Kiwon Lacy, that's probably the fumble. That's probably it. It's probably not going to happen again. So,
well, his legs were certainly fine.
I think Ole Miss is going to attack with Kiwon Lacy, and he's a more violent runner than anybody Miami's seen so far in this playoff. I'm trying to think. They've had to play Jeremiah Love, so they've played some really good backs. But they played Isaac Brown at Louisville. So I think that's going to be interesting too. I love this game because it's a coin flip. Yeah. It's a complete coin flip.
The two games you just mentioned for Miami, one was a win, one was a loss, but they were both very close. That's interesting that you mentioned that. So maybe it is just physical ground game. They don't need to be relying on this Manziel nonsense. I know everybody's kind of smitten with that right now.
The Louisville loss for Miami, it's interceptions.
That was Beck. Yeah, that's Carson.
Yeah,
Beck.
It was interceptions. Yeah. So that's you've seen them try very hard not to force him to have to make those throws. And so far it's worked.
Like, by the way, Trinidad, I think, is going 130 attempts now without interception. I think over almost four games, spans almost
just
four games.
Just jinxed him, Ross. Good Lord.
I know.
Bryce Fitzgerald's like, all right.
I'm sorry.
First drive. Charlie's going
to I cannot wait for this game. I'm so excited. But we also need to talk about the game in Atlanta because we've seen it once this season. But I think both teams are playing quite a bit better than they were when we saw them earlier in the season. So we'll talk about that when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and a reminder, if you'd like to see us live and in living color, go to yahoosports.tv, laptop, phone, tablet, doesn't matter. All of the Yahoo Sports Network shows are there. Also, if you turn on your smart TV, find that Yahoo Sports Network icon, click it, and you will see all of the Yahoo Sports Network offerings, including the College Football Inquirer, where we are talking about the Peach Bowl. That is the Indiana-Oregon rematch, but it's a different version of Indiana, a different version of Oregon than when they played in Eugene back in October.
Fundamentally different for Oregon. And then we would say at peaking Indiana,
similar to Indiana,
just at their best. How's that?
Yeah. Oregon was forced to change, especially offensively, what they do because they had some pretty key injuries. They lost DeCorian Moore for a while. They lost Kenyon Sadiq for a minute. They lost Gary Bryant Jr. for a while. And so they had to really find more weapons, and they did. And I think so. You're going to see a little more complete Oregon attack because obviously DeCorian Moore's back, Gary Bryant Jr.'s back, Kenyon Sadiq's been back for a while. So you've got that. But to Godfrey's point, Ross, Indiana looks like the best possible version of Indiana the last couple of games we've seen them play.
Yeah, we're just talking about the accuracy of Trinidad Chambliss, and the only one that comes to mind that's been more consistently accurate, especially, you know, on the run and stuff, is Fernando Mendoza. He's been incredible. And we talked about this, I think, last week, is that just look at what Indiana's done to get to this point in the teams that they've beaten, especially the last couple times out in Ohio State and in Alabama. And they crushed Alabama, obviously, and beat Ohio State in a way. And Andy, I think you said this at some point during the season, like Indiana wins in just different ways and different styles. And they've proven that it doesn't matter that they can win the game. If they have to rely on defense and score 20 points or 15 points, they can do that. If they can win and they have to score 40, they can do that. So yeah, it's hard to see anybody stopping the train here with the Hoosiers. It is, but with a fully healthy Oregon, maybe that's the thing that could give them trouble.
This roster for Oregon has dudes all over the place. Like Young Concrete, Mateo Uiagalelei. The play he makes to steal the ball from Baron Morton and set up the first touchdown of the Orange Bowl. Not many people can make that play. I was watching it in slow-mo a few minutes ago, and that is just a superior athlete. Like with the ball in his hands, he looks completely natural. And I know he played tight end in high school. He's obviously DJ Uiagalelei's younger brother, and DJ played quarterback. But this is the level of athlete Oregon has. I mean, Kenyon Sadiq is an absolute freak. Nobody has a player like him. Then Bryce Betcher at linebacker, two sports star, is just a guy who can play all over the field. I love their roster. But the thing about Indiana is that the guys aren't as freaky sexy athletically, but they get it done, and they're all going to wind up playing in the NFL. The Indiana Midwest guys and the Oregon guys.
Very Midwest. You're not as freaky sexy, but you get that job done.
You get a
shout out to my freaky sexy Midwest. Does anyone remember how many times Dante Moore was sacked in this game? The first time these teams played?
I'm actually looking it up right now.
If you want a recipe for success, you hold the opposing team to under 100 yards rushing. Oregon finished with 86, and you sack their quarterback 6 times, forcing 2 interceptions too. That's a pretty good recipe for success.
Wow.
Indiana's defense was horrific. Horrific to Moore in this offense in the first game. And they still managed to get 20 points on the board. So this is where I default
defense
to
scored
different.
7 of those.
That's true. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
The pick 6.
Right. That's right. So this is why box scores, it's like they get more deceptive with age. You start forgetting little things. Yeah, this is why I want to know how different Oregon is on offense.
That pick 6, I think, tied the score maybe in the second half. I remember
20-20
after that. Yeah, after that play, I remember thinking, well, this is it, right? They're at Oregon, like, you know, they're back in the game, tied game, like this. The Indiana is going to lose this game, and that was, I remember when they just, you know, when they were coming back, I'm like scratching my head, like, this doesn't compute.
They caught the kickoff and they marched it right. I think it was a touchback on the kickoff. 75 yard drive.
Yeah.
Fernando Mendoza didn't even look like he was sweating. Like that was the drive that should have told us stop doubting these people.
Well, no. Okay. This is what I was getting at. And this is like the amnesia of sports media. I'm pretty sure that if you pull up our reaction show from that Sunday, that's exactly what we said, that this was the arrival moment. This was the arrival moment on the road to certify Indiana.
Kurt Cignetti told us this was going to happen. No one believed him. We kept saying it was because of the schedule. Now, I believe all of those complaints about Indiana are dead, I think.
We officially played somebody. There is no way to justify this or to take the flowers away from the Hoosiers. This is an intimidating environment, a top 5 team, yada, yada, yada. That's dead. That's done. We can stop now, right? This is maybe the second best, if not an argument for the best team in the league.
Yes, and an argument for possibly the best team in the country.
Because it's crazy now to talk about it in January of 2026, but we were all still lingering from that Notre Dame playoff debacle, right? We still weren't convinced of the legitimacy of Indiana against quality opponents. Remember that whole spiel?
Yeah.
They blew out Illinois. That was probably the most convincing win they had to date, but that wasn't going to do anything to convince people otherwise that they still weren't fraudulent because of the logo on their helmet. This was the game. This was when we decided that Indiana could be for real. Or some of us did. I guess people were still doubting before Ohio State.
Aiden Fisher was an absolute monster in this game, by the way. Yeah. 13 tackles, 1.5 sacks. Like it was, and that's the thing. You got to understand, Indiana has stars on its team. For whatever reason, we've not given them as much as much run as we have some of these guys from other teams. I mean, Aiden Fisher, one of the best players in the country. D'Angelo Pons. Trust me, D'Angelo Pons was a scary, scary dude to deal with long before he hit Ty Simpson and knocked him out of the game or knocked the ball out of his hands and ultimately knocked him out of the game. These guys have been great all along, and it's so crazy that most of their big stars were at JMU with Kurt Cignetti. These were not people who were recruited heavily out of high school. These are people that Kurt Cignetti ID'd and developed. And so it's interesting because they are a transfer portal team in some ways, but they are also a developmental team in a lot of ways. Oregon is kind of the perfect blend of transfer portal and developmental. And so is Miami.
I had a Big Ten fundraiser, let's call him, text me sort of like aghast and just like, I think, stunned after the Rose Bowl and said, seriously, what is it? It has to be more than the portal. But I think it's exactly what you just said. This is a portal development program.
Yeah.
We're talking about a coach and a staff that's really, really good at IDing
talent.
It won't
be portal when he's been there a couple of years.
Right.
Because,
although they did just land some big portal guys.
Well, yeah, I don't think they're
Josh Hoover. Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about this while you were out on Sunday, Ross. Like we were trying to kind of qualify and classify ideal blueprints moving forward. Like how much portal, how do you develop? Like, you know, we went through this almost by position group, but I don't think they're ever going to stop making a splash in the portal. But also it's here's what I think we've learned so far. And I think this is the lesson to take from Indiana. It's not how much you portal and it's not how often. It's are your bets in the portal correct? But bets is probably a bad sports writer term. It's a cliche. What we should be saying is like these guys are really good at identifying talent and then developing talent. And I would also pose back to you, Andy, that maybe the reason that their stars don't get as much shine is that they are so close to that 2012-2014 era Alabama where it's so almost boring, like slow cooker, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a sort of playmaker's quality. Because remember, like Julio Jones played for Alabama and you never really saw Julio Jones moments like you did in the NFL because the system didn't dictate, you know, he would have some catch and runs.
So what's the one moment with Indiana this year? It's Omar Cooper making that catch.
Yeah.
Against Penn State. Now, Charlie Becker had a catch that was almost as amazing on the same drive. And you saw Charlie Becker make that catch in the Rose Bowl. But you have not seen that much of that because they haven't really needed it. But back to something Ross said about Oregon, you said Indiana being able to win games in multiple ways.
Yeah.
That's something we've seen Oregon prove it can do since they lost Indiana. Like both these teams are built to win a national championship. Because they can do that.
Yeah. But, I mean, look at the Iowa game, that they played, right?
Both Iowa games for these teams.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We've seen, I mean, heck, you know, not to discount Miami and Ole Miss, but there'd probably be a lot of people out there that would say that these two are the best teams and had sort of had the best.
Yeah.
You know, right?
I think the winner of this game is going to be favored in the national title game.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So the other thing to the point about not emerging stars, I think you need stakes to develop stars. It's like the pressure builds diamonds moment. Go through and just look at, you don't have to look at the game logs. Just look at the quarter by quarter box scores. Indiana just hasn't had a lot of stressful moments. I know we're coming off the Big Ten championship.
We just talked
game,
about
like,
the most stressful moment of the year. After the pick six.
Yeah. And a day that I think Cignetti qualified the Penn State game, not so much as a dramatic game. It's just like there was a lot of self, you know, that was just a bad Indiana game. That's probably the second most dramatic thing that they've had to deal with all season. They've just been automatic. How many minutes this year, if you totaled it up, have they been playing with a lead? It's substantial compared to the other teams left in this tournament.
And just like last year, it was the same thing. Remember, it was kind of the same thing up until the end last year. It's a bit as impressive as a two seasons anywhere, let alone the, you know, that it's coming from a historical
The biggest difference between
school.
This year and last year, and I think everybody's now on board with the Indiana thing. I don't think we have to convince anybody anymore.
No.
But the biggest difference is their stars are just as good as everybody else's stars. Their stars are as good as Ohio State stars. Their stars are as good as Oregon stars. Their stars are as good as Alabama star. Like, they're as good or better than those people's stars. Like, maybe they don't have a receiver who's better than Jeremiah Smith, But actually, the if you go Elijah Surratt, Charlie Becker, Omar Cooper, I'm okay with that against Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate. Like, that's, mm-hmm. I can live with that. I feel pretty good about that. I put that receiving core up against anybody.
Andy, you mentioned the Iowa game as a sort of kind of like a bellwether evaluation because it's a similar opponent. To call back to Sunday's episode and maybe some offseason, and Ross, I'm sure you'll have some reportage here soon on this, but like, as we continue to constantly reevaluate and rejigger the playoff format, what about, like, how different do you think these teams would be viewed, or like Indiana more so than Oregon, I think, if Iowa is that last team in a playoff? You think about the quality in which that they played both of these opponents. That game is not nearly as, or it's a lot harder to discount that game if we're talking about Iowa as a playoff caliber program.
Oh, I've stopped like watching Iowa against Vanderbilt. Like,
yeah,
that was not my nat, because during the season I was like, this makes me worry about Indiana and Oregon. It no longer makes me worry. It explains why they're here.
Exactly. Iowa becomes a lot more respectable of a crucible for these Big Ten teams to survive, especially when you go there and you have to do the shtick we always talk about where you kind of have to become Iowa to beat Iowa. But I just think the merit and value of that team, I feel like I've misevaluated the program, especially the last 3 or 4 years, as kind of this gimmicky, like Ferentz is long in the tooth and they're never going to innovate on offense.
Oh, if they get the right QB, they're making the playoff.
But like, look at these raw game results. And this is kind of dawning on me in real time. Like, this is a mandate on how we're evaluating some of these playoff teams. And I know there's a lot of, it's not just comparative analysis and recency bias and this kind of stuff, but like, when you factor in the complete obliteration of Alabama by Indiana, and then looking at Iowa's sort of data that they put up against these last two teams in the Final Four, I think we're doing something wrong here. I think we are shortchanging the middle class of the Big Ten.
Yeah, I was just about to say, maybe the big class's middle is not as bad as we all thought, right?
I would agree with that. And in Iowa especially, I think we should be looking at Iowa as a team that should have been considered. I mean, obviously, they lost to Iowa State. They had 4 losses. But if they could have beaten USC, there would have been probably a legitimate case to be made for them at 9-3 to be considered, just like Texas, you know, just in that bucket.
Yeah. And I think that's what I'm getting at here, guys, is I don't know they would have been. I don't know if they beat out, like, they would have been at 9-3 more deserving of the bid than Alabama having recently played in the SEC championship. But we all know that that's not going to happen. We've turned Atlanta into an auto bid for two teams, and maybe it shouldn't be.
Yeah. This game is going to be fascinating, though. I can't wait. It's another coin flip, just like we said about the first game. And I realize Indiana won the first one. It is really hard to discount that might have been a bad Indiana game, Godfrey, just like you just said.
Yeah.
And if it was, then we got something to talk about. But I also think Oregon's better than when they played. I think Oregon's learned about itself in the process here.
Really fast, you mentioned this at the very top of the show about 4 teams on almost equal footing in vying for a national title. If you just kind of run through, and I'm doing this quickly in my head because it's easy with some of the blowouts, this is the most parity we've ever seen in any playoff bracket in the history of the sport, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not even close.
Yeah, I went back through the 4-team. There was no year where I thought all 4 teams had a chance.
Sure. In fact, you had a lot of goose eggs and blowouts and, you know, the Ohio State team that got, I think it was 31-0 to Clemson, and the Michigan State team that just got killed by Bama.
That first year might have been the one in 2014.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Alabama, like, we didn't know how good Ohio State was at that point.
They were the first
Cardale Jones had just come in. But we knew Florida State was probably going to lay an egg because they had been so close to laying one all season.
They were the defending national champion. And they were probably the worst of those 4. Yeah. And then you had, for people who don't remember, this is Marcus Mariota's Oregon. This is the Amari Cooper, Blake Sims, Lane Kiffin, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And then the eventual national champion, sort of the kind of like return to power for the Big Ten, that Ohio State.
Zeke Elliott, Cardale Jones. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many yards to the heart of the South, boys? 74 yards to the heart of the South?
Wasn't it in the 80s? I don't know. Or 76, we'll maybe.
We got to ask the guys at 11 Warriors, because guess what? They're still selling that t-shirt.
Yeah, well, Billy Price blocked like didn't just block two people on that play, like wiped out two people on that play.
Mm-hmm. I was on the sidelines. I think that's still probably the most important college football game I've ever seen.
We discussed this, but like, you know, three of the four teams left would be first time, at least wire service, you know, major national champions for the first time in their history, which, as we discussed, been 30 years since the Andy's Florida Gators.
Andy, do we hit on that on Sunday or was it Thursday? No, you were on that team. Come on, dude.
Well, yes, I was a human tackling dummy for starting defense. Got yelled at by Bob Stoops a lot, but other than that,
has Stoopsy apologized?
We've talked about it. That
okay.
There's a great moment.
I didn't hear an apology in there.
There's a great moment LSU week of that year. They had me playing Alan Faneca for some reason. I don't know why.
Nice.
Because there were certainly more talented guards who could play Alan Faneca on the scout
playing
team.
Playing the role of Alan Faneca.
Yes. And so there was one play where I just simply could not do what Alan Faneca does. Because Alan Faneca could pull from the backside, hit the playside guard on a sweep, or hit the playside linebacker on a sweep. And like, you have to be probably a future Hall of Fame lineman to do that. And I couldn't do it. Stoops pulls me out and is screaming at me. Because we've now run the play like five times. And he's like, since you're so slow, we're going to put you in a sprinter stance back here. And then maybe you can get to Mike Peterson is the linebacker in question who played 12 years in the NFL. Not getting to Mike Peterson. And
come on,
I wanted to say to Bob Stoops at the time was, Coach, if I could do this, I would not be on this field here with you. I would be on that field with the starters. I did not say that, but I did say that to him when I interviewed him in Oklahoma once and he laughed. So,
look, you have a ring and you're in the roster in the media guide, right?
I'm in the picture. I'm in the team picture.
That count it, baby.
Good enough.
Count it.
Mike Moten's head. Mike Moten was a defensive tackle who became an SEC referee or not an official. I believe he's a field judge, but Mike Moten's head is obscuring a lot of my face. You can see enough of it.
Hey, we talked about this with teams claiming titles. You can claim that, man. Easy.
Where are you keeping your ring, by the way?
Yeah, where's your ring?
It's in an undisclosed location near my wife's sock drawer.
Okay. I'll leave that alone.
No, I actually like the SEC ring better from a design standpoint, but of course the national championship ring is.
Because low key, did everyone catch what he just did? He's got one of those too. That's what he's letting y'all know.
Humble brag.
I also got some t-shirts.
Drop
that, I kept
that
too.
There. All
right. Gentlemen, we have to talk a little bit more about the college football calendar because Ross Dellinger has some information on that. And I think this is going to be a major debate as we deal with all this transfer portal stuff at the same time as the college football playoff semifinals.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it when we come back. We are back, College Football Inquirer, and yes, while the college football playoff semifinals are going on, obviously that is the big topic of discussion this week. Everywhere else where they're not still playing, they're wondering, who are we losing in the transfer portal? Who are we getting in the transfer portal? It is NFL free agency on steroids, but Ross Dellinger, the machinery working behind the scenes to again tweak the calendar, because this is not ideal.
No, it's not. And funny anecdote, I was in New Orleans, obviously, for the Sugar Bowl, and I walk into the locker room, you know, everybody's celebrating and all that. And one man, though, is sort of meandering through the locker room, kind of, I would say, like in a huff, like exasperated. And that was one Austin Thomas, the program's new general manager. And he said to a few of us media members, "The portal opens in a couple hours," you know? So this time of year is nuts, right? You have this confluence of events of the back end of the coaching carousel where schools are hiring and firing coordinators and assistant coaches. The roster retainment and replacement stuff is humming as the portal opened. I think I got a stat the other day that 1/5 of FBS players on the roster are in the portal right now. So that's... yeah, one of every five of your players on your team are in the portal. And then, of course, teams are preparing and playing for bowls and playoff games. So something needs to change, right? We heard Nick Saban Thursday kind of rant about this again, about the calendar and his idea.
Does he have any solutions that aren't illegal, though?
God, with him. Why are we looking at this man?
He wants to have an NFL-like calendar, right? He wants to shove the portal into the spring and eliminate spring practice and do summer
OTAs.
That's
doable. That is doable. He's got to get all the other coaches on board, though. They're the ones holding that up.
They're the ones.
Didn't the coaches vote for this date?
They wanted a January portal.
Yeah. So I just let's not do the woe is me thing for the coaches. They voted on this.
They did. They voted on that. So anyway, back to what's we're gonna have happen this offseason is the NCAA football oversight, led by mostly athletic directors, Georgia athletic director Josh Brooks and Buffalo AD Mark Alden are kind of leading it. But they are back to examining the calendar and are expected to probably at some point recommend significant changes to a variety of things. And I'll go through them each and we can discuss. Number one is the early signing period. Should there be an early signing period? When should it be? Number two, the future of week zero. Should everybody play on week zero and it become week one? And then you can have a flexibility sort of in the schedule. Number two, the college football playoff dates, shifting those around, potentially making those earlier, that kind of jives with the week zero stuff. Number three, mm-hmm. the date of the portal, as we just mentioned. Number four, spring and summer access period. So those are kind of, what should happen during those times. So I would guess by the end of this offseason, based on conversations with administrators on the oversight committee and the coaches again, who are going to be involved, there will be some changes to the calendar.
So just real fast, the access periods, can you go into detail specifically? Because I think most people aren't familiar with that term.
Yeah. So, right now you have 15 spring practices, obviously, and you have in the summer, you have sort of voluntary work, right? You're not supposed to have a team practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking to a player of I'll not mention the name of the school. And he's like, oh yeah, when, coach was out there with us when we were doing our June practice, and he stopped and he said, oh,
that didn't happen.
I don't know that I'm supposed to say that.
Yeah.
Like, well, you just did. But anyway.
How far away were you standing? That's, yeah.
Yeah. but the idea, the AFCA, the coaches came out, American Football Coaches Association, came out last year with a proposal that would have, you'd have 21 practice days to spread across spring and summer, including an OTA type in the summer. So the idea is to slowly eliminate spring practice. And as Nick Saban had mentioned, shift everything to like May, portal, June, OTAs.
Don't slowly eliminate, just eliminate it.
Kill it.
Yeah.
Kill it. Everybody
have OTAs that start with the first summer period. Like the school's on a semester period or semester system. You end your spring semester, your exams are in like the first week of May, and then your summer school starts in late May. That summer A block, like that's when you start your OTAs. And you do the OTAs through late May, early June. That's your spring practice or your version of spring practice.
Yeah.
And that's when the NFL does them.
Yeah, I can't think of a physiological strength and conditioning world pushback on eliminating spring. I think most people
the only thing coaches have told me is they don't like it because they do feel like if you have spring practice in March, if you get some injuries in spring practice, that there is time to fully rehab. Like obviously, a torn ACL is not going to be the same thing, but a lot of injuries you can fully rehab in time. But I don't think that's because your roster is going to be set. You may have some position battles, but it's not going to be the same thing as now where you're having position battles and then there used to be a portal window after that and then whoever lost the position battle is leaving.
Also, if you're tearing important ACLs in March, you're doing something wrong, because one of the things Indiana, again, has done extremely well is how light they practice and how fresh
Did you see the clip of Cignetti that's floating around from the it's something sponsored by CoachCom, which is one of the
And I know what you're talking about.
He's talking about Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, hour 35, hour 45. That's your hard cap on your practice time.
That's crazy. For those of us who grew up covering the sport for me, it was the early aughts. Like that's a short amount of time.
It's incredibly efficient, which means your meetings are very informative.
Are hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would anybody shed a tear over spring football?
No, not really.
I think so.
I think it's really. I was DMing back and forth with a coach of a power conference team, and they want exactly what Nick Saban had talked about. And their league, a lot of the coaches had been for that, with one notable exception. But I don't know that was the consensus last year when they voted. I'll be curious. The AFCA convention is this weekend or early next week, mm-hmm. to hear if anybody's changed their mind on that. I think we will.
I think they will. I think there's going to be a meeting Monday and Tuesday. Tuesday is the full coaches, the annual coaches meeting. I think there are going to be some meetings Monday with smaller groups about the calendar to get to a point on Tuesday where they can have some real discussion on what to do about some of these concepts. But the idea is, you know, to slow down the coaching carousel to prevent a lot of the more early season firings or the rush hires that we saw this year, is just keep moving everything back instead of forward. So like Greg Sankey, I sat down with him in New Orleans at the Sugar Bowl, and one of the things he wants to see happen, he wants to see the NC Football Oversight Committee eliminate the early signing period and wants it back in February to alleviate the coaching stuff and all the December.
What if you could just
that would be fine.
What if you could just sign when you wanted to, but signing day was in February? If you're done and you're locked in and you want to sign with the school,
well, but whatever first day you're allowed to sign will be the new signing day. You know what I mean? Like that, like whatever first day, if it's your first senior year of high school, if it's your last day of high, whatever they set the start date is going to be the new signing day.
I would have no problem with them going back to that first Wednesday in February because the early enrollees are still going to enroll early.
Well, that's an issue too. That's part of a conversation that's going to be had too, is the mid-year enrollees in January. And is there anything that can be done since you're pushing everything? And if you're potentially eliminating spring, well, all of a sudden you don't need people to enroll necessarily.
Yeah, they don't really need to. Yeah, because summer A in the semester system is when your freshmen were getting there in the first place.
Yep. Yeah. And so that's a conversation going to be had as well.
I think I'm okay. I have to measure this. I think I'm okay with the idea of discouraging early enrollment. If you have kids that are lopping off the last year of high school semester of high school to get on campus purely for practice reasons, if you're not actually clashing helmets on April 10th on a Saturday, then there's no reason to do that. I think that's
what's really the issue with pushing all this like into the spring.
Make some memories.
The biggest issue is, I think players who after the season have already decided they're going to transfer, waiting and sitting on campus for four more months and actually going to class at that school in the spring before going, into the portal. And that's what Kirby Smart, right? Yeah. He argued against a spring portal. He was one of the loudest ones this past summer. And it's because of that. He wanted his team all together starting in January, not starting in May.
And that was the chief argument. It wasn't just Kirby. That was most coaches. Yeah, yeah. That was their chief argument. And he's not wrong about that. He understands the psychology of the players. Like once their season's over and they've decided they're moving on, they don't want to sit around. Like they want
to. Right, but you're going to have to sacrifice. One of these things has to be sacrificed.
I know. And the thing is that they get used to it. And it would actually give them time. It would actually give them time to make a more informed decision.
Yes.
So the biggest change or shift, I think, would be this week zero, right? And we've talked about it before. I think back one of my On3 business columns back in August, I think, was about this, how they were exploring the possibility of eliminating the waiver process for week zero. Right now, you need a waiver to play on week zero, and they eliminate the waiver process, and then you shift, everybody starts to play on week zero and because they want an extra bye week. But then eventually, do you shift up the entire regular season?
Yes.
And then make week one, week zero. And that way, then you can shift the playoff games up. But there's sort of an issue with completely shifting up all the playoff games because then you move the semifinals from the first week of January back to New Year's Day. Well,
That's their not bowl a problem. Games,
who would
play.
Yeah,
that's a solution.
That's
not
all the bowl games. All the bowl games. I'm just telling you the problem brought up by a certain group.
Brought up by who, Ross?
Yes, by the bowl group. They want to play on New Year's Day, right? Their quarterfinals want to play on New Year's Day.
Your time is over.
Yeah, don't care.
Bye.
You should be more useful to the sport then.
Put them on campus until the championship game. Stick it in Pasadena so all you nerds can marvel at your sunset.
Hey,
that's fine.
No, I got one better. If you still want to insist on having the semis at bowls,
yeah,
the Rose and the Sugar are your semis every year.
Absolutely fine. Don't
I'm
care.
Sure the Cotton and Orange and the Fiesta would be fine with that. Would be fine.
I'm sure they wouldn't be.
I
wasn't
list.
Fine with my newspaper that I work for going out of business. But
well, here's what you could
things
do.
Happen.
Here's what you could do in that. And I've talked to nobody about this. I'm just like thinking out loud here. Is that right now you have the six bowls, right? The Peach, Fiesta, Orange, Cotton, Rose,
Sugar.
What am I missing?
Sugar.
Sugar.
You have those that are in the rotation of the quarters and the semis. Well, then maybe they then transition into a rotation of the semis in the championship game. That only leaves you with three games as far as six, mm-hmm. but they could rotate three on, three off, three on, three
or
off. Maybe do that.
Or
they just
I don't care. Or yeah. bye. No one
I'm
gives
trying
a
to
shit.
Compromise here.
No,
guys.
There's no. Here's the patience that I
there's
have.
No need to compromise with them. That's the thing. It's sort of like when you're doing guests for shows, like when somebody asks you to be a guest on their show and it's somebody who you'd love to also have on your show, by all means, you're going to do that.
Sure.
But when it's somebody who asks to be a guest on your show and you would never have them as a guest on your show, you're a little less inclined.
Okay.
If I'm the people running college football, what do the Bulls do for me anymore?
Nothing. Nothing.
They used to grease me with free golf and stuff, but I make millions of dollars now. I can buy whatever golf I need. I can buy my cruises myself. I don't need the Orange Bowl to do that for me.
Hey, have we pointed out real fast that Ole Miss and Miami are traveling to MFing Phoenix this week?
To Arizona.
And Oregon and Indiana is traveling
are going
to
Atlanta.
To Atlanta.
It's
stupid. No, it doesn't make any sense.
For reason whatsoever other than to pacify a structure that serves no purpose.
Yeah, the game should be in Bloomington and Oxford. And I'm willing to compromise and have them be in Pasadena and New Orleans.
Even the semis, you think? I mean, I get the argument of the quarterfinals moving to home sites. I mean, that
if
makes
only
a
there
lot
were
of sense
a football
to me,
tournament that had all the games at home sites through the semis that was very popular and people liked.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh wait,
there's a few of those.
I'm going. Shout out by the way to the FCS championship game.
Yeah, there you go.
After you guys see this, it'll be over. So I will be covering a let's go safe Montana State win.
Cool.
Yes, there's a million ways to do this, and the Bulls are only trying to complicate what should be every Ross. Let's go back for a second to what you talked about. Shifting up the calendar makes more and better sense for the stakeholders of the sport and the individuals participating. It makes more sense for the individual schools, the NIL collect, literally, I don't want to list them all. There's no point in doing that. All the way down to us in the media. The only people raising an objection, this is the same I heard last year about how weather was going to destroy this, or there's not enough hotels in Oxford, Mississippi, or all this other bullshit. Sorry. It's not, none of that panned out. None of that panned out.
Well,
guys.
Of course, if only we had evidence that they play seven home games a year, every year in Oxford, Mississippi, and somehow everybody manages.
Yeah, they hosted that game against Tulane. Nobody died and everybody got a hotel room. Stop with this. This filtering in of this influence. I can't believe they still have a voice. Who is platforming these people at this point?
The people who have not retired yet, who haven't forgotten when they got greased by them when they needed to be greased. They don't need to be greased anymore.
I know Kirk Herbstreit loves the Rose Bowl and they gave him a plaque and he platforms anything that they want, but they should not have. I'm fine even acquiescing to the Rose. Like we've mentioned it multiple times, Andy. Let's stick him in some sort of permanent
rotation.
No,
they don't want to be the national championship game only if it can't be on the first with their beautiful parade. Again, enjoy
then
your tractor pull.
I got two words for
Bigfoot
you.
Bigfoot and
Gravedigger
can take over on January 1.
I do not care. Okay, I'm sorry. And guess what? Neither does college football anymore.
Yep. The people want games on their televisions. They do not care where they emanate from. And oh, by the way, if they emanate from campus, they're better.
Every single time. Hey, look, this got lost in the shuffle because Oklahoma blew a second half lead. that environment was insane.
A&M was unbelievable, even though they lost. Yeah.
But I'm talking about the nighttime, the light show. I had more people casually in like entertainment and media who have nothing to do with sports or college football say like, damn, that's some P.T. Barnum, right? Like you guys.
I wonder how many people saw the Sooner Schooner for the first time that night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guess what? Like, everybody had a hotel room. There wasn't an ice storm. Everything was fine.
Even if there had been an ice storm. They play playoff games at Lambeau Field, and that's a feature, not a bug.
I watched a bowl game a couple days ago that had torrential rain in Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you something about the quality and passion of football. When it is late December and it is raining sideways in Memphis, Tennessee, and you got to play Navy, buddy, those Cincinnati players were like, God, please send this to the end. That is some dedication to the sport when you got to play a triple option team in the rain.
Hey, what's everybody's favorite? Well, maybe you guys are too young for this. One of my favorite bowl games ever. In the middle of an ice storm.
The Snow Bowl?
Or snowstorm.
Are you talking about Mississippi State?
A&M Mississippi State and Shreveport.
Yeah, dude. No. I was in college for that.
The Snow Bowl, baby. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I was in college, dude. That's and they great. Changed the uniforms because A&M and Mississippi State were too similar to begin with.
Too similar.
With.
Yep.
Wasn't that the birth, Ross, of the white helmet?
The white. I think maybe so. Yeah. Yeah.
So with the interlocking logo.
We love the bowls because we love football games. We do not love the bowls having any control over the top of the sport. So
no.
Yeah.
Correct. That's
where it is. I can't wait to the Coastal Convention. I can't wait to hear if a little common sense is going to reign. Maybe. Just maybe. Maybe.
A lot of quarter zips, a lot of Miller Lite. Get ready.
You will hear from us next on Saturday. Unusual schedule, but normally we'd go on Thursday, but there's a game Thursday night that's of significant importance and a game Friday night of significant importance. So
because this tournament is poorly scheduled.
Stop it. When the national championship game is set, we will be with you on Saturday. So we will talk to you then.